From WXXI News, I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson, and it is Summer Book Week on Connections. Imagine yourself up on stage in front of an audience. Spotlight is on you. Microphone is on. You can hear papers rustling in the audience. Are you excited to go out and perform, or do you suddenly have butterflies in your stomach, or even worse? Stage fright is something that affects a lot of us, more than you may even realize, and it is the subject of a new history and memoir, Playing Scared, by Sarah Solovich, who grew up in Western New York and is a graduate of the Eastman School of Music, and who joins us for this hour of Summer Book Week here on Connections. Sarah joins us from the studios of KAZU at California State University, Monterey Bay. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you here. Let's establish, first of all, because we're all about talking local this week when the opportunity arises, you grew up originally on the Canadian side of the border over in Port Colborne, Ontario, but then you moved to Hornell, right?
Yes, I moved upstate when I was 16 years old. And part of the reason, not entirely, but a big part of the reason was so that I could attend the preparatory division of Eastman School of Music. So every Saturday morning, I would get up very early and catch the bus, and we would kind of wind through all these little towns in upstate New York, and about 10 or 10:15 in the morning, I would arrive in Rochester and walk over to Eastman and spend almost the entire day there taking classes.
And then you continued studying there past preparatory, right?
No, I graduated the preparatory division, and I decided to quit piano at that point and go off to university. So I actually took a hiatus from playing the piano for 30 years.
Right, which, of course, is the subject of the book itself, is how you came back into doing this. It is a fascinating memoir. It's been excerpted. You might be thinking, where did I see this? There was an excerpt, New York Times Magazine, I believe, a couple of months back. And the book itself has been out for a couple of months now, and hopefully you've had a chance to read it. It's on our summer reading list. You go to WXXINews.org and click on the summer books link on the right side of the page, and you can see everything we'll be talking about, including Playing Scared. What happened? You realized very early on, even before you were in the conservatory, this was something, when it went beyond just being by yourself in a room with a piano, that anything more than that you weren't at ease with.
Yeah, it was around 10 or 11 years old when I began being entered into competitions and music festivals that weren't on their own any really big thing, but they were competitive and evaluative. And I very quickly developed this terrible anxiety around performance. It was pretty extreme. My hands would break out in a sweat so that they would just be dripping with water and I could no longer control them on the keys. They would slip and slide across the keyboard. And my knees knocked against each other. My feet trembled so much they couldn't hold down the pedals. And I would just completely lose my presence of mind. And then, of course, my memory, which I had worked really hard to memorize a lot of pieces, you know, this music, and I would have terrible memory lapses. So I was pretty much a disaster on stage.
And yet, from all accounts, you were talented enough, obviously, to be spotted and encouraged to go to Eastman. At that point, you know, and here we're talking 1960s, right? Point, there wasn't really a science yet of stage fright. There weren't really studies of it. Did anybody notice at that point and say, hey, you need help with this? Or was it just, hey, I can't do this anymore?
Well, what happened was, I think it was one of the very last competitions I entered, and it was a larger one, quite a bit bigger than the previous ones had been. And you're right, I hadn't been given any real help or preparation for nerves. My teacher before I went to Eastman was actually a very good piano teacher, but nobody really had any thoughts, any ideas about how to control one's anxiety besides the typical things that people said to children, which was, imagine that everyone out in the audience is in their underwear, or that you're playing for a barnyard full of animals. And that really just did not do very much for me, especially when I was just panicked. I was in the fight or flight syndrome, and I was no longer thinking. But what happened when I went to St. Catherine's was, I remember I was playing a Mozart sonata, and I had a number of errors and my usual gaffes and embarrassments. But at the end of, when all was said and done, the adjudicator went up and spoke to everybody and, started giving out the prizes, and he gave me second prize. And it was, in my memory at least, it was almost as if there was a political revolt. This murmur spread through the audience, and it must have been loud enough because I clearly recall him holding up his hand as if to stem some kind of revolt and explaining to the audience why he decided to give it to me and acknowledge that, yes, she made mistakes, but that she was talented and she was musical. And this was so reaffirming to my mother, who had huge dreams for me, that that ended up being a reason for our move across the border. And this man, whose name was Harold Weiss, ended up becoming my teacher. About a year later, when we moved to the States, my mom called Eastman and asked for this adjudicator, Weiss, and asked him if he remembered me, and he did. And she asked if he would take me on as a teacher, or as a student, of course. And he did. And the first thing that he said to me when I walked into his studio was, "There will be no more competitions." He was a very wonderful man.
So even if the science wasn't there, he knew at least that you needed to be reassured to be able to keep doing as much as you were doing at Eastman.
Yes, and he just kind of, just changed the whole approach about how I would play. I continued to play in public, but it wasn't competitive. There were no more festivals and competitions. It was simply, there were recitals occasionally. I remember there were teachers, from the Rochester area who would occasionally come in to Eastman to see what the teachers there were doing and how the students were, were getting on and what the training encompassed. And so I remember playing for, kind of groups of like private teachers, but it wasn't competitive, and that made all the difference for me.
And you went on to a career as a journalist. You wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You've appeared in Esquire and Wired, the Washington Post. None of that has caused you any nervousness over the years. It's just the piano piece of it.
It's funny, isn't it? That's
yeah.
Exactly right. And I, there's certainly, many of the same things happen when I'm on deadline and there's a lot riding on a story and people are expecting it and it's going to be edited. But in that circumstance, I am able to rise to the occasion. I certainly feel the nerves, but I also thrill to it. I get that kind of thrill that people, have when they're, say, on a roller coaster, for instance. I love it. But put me in front of, at a piano in front of a few people, and I melt.
We are talking to Sarah Solovich, author of Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright, here on Book Week on WXXI's Connections. You can join us, too. You're welcome to call us at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I am on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. You can chime in there as well. Hopefully you've had a chance to read the book. I know I was told by a couple of people that it was all checked out of the library here when they went to look for it, so I hope that's a good sign that we've got some folks who are reading today. What came first, this idea that for your 60th birthday you were going to figure out how to get back up on a stage and how to give a recital in front of friends and family, or the idea that, gee, I want to write a book about this?
That's a good question. The two went completely hand in hand. I had gone to a party, a cocktail party, for my husband's office. And at that party, I had been asked to play something. I resumed studying the piano and playing again when I was 49. And so several years had gone by. And I went to this party, and my husband apparently had been bragging about my playing at the at the office. And people started asking me if I would play. And I said no, and they kept asking. And as they kept saying, play, play, what I heard was, jump, jump. And at that point, especially going home that night, I just felt really almost embarrassed in front of my husband of 25 years. And I realized that I had to do something about it, that this had been a fear that was just kind of following me around. And it was stronger than ever after I, you know, returned to the piano 30 years later. So I decided that I would explore the science and psychology of stage fright to understand, you know, where and how it began in the brain and how it could be triggered over and over again. And then I would talk to people in all walks of life, and I would use myself as a window to see what remedies worked and whether it could be overcome. And at the end of the year, I would give a performance for a hall full of people. But what I knew in my bones was that this was a really good idea, but it was terrifying. And probably the only way that I would really do it was if there was some external kind of force that was calling me to do it, that I had to, you know, kind of there was an expectation. It was almost like I would have to have a deadline, because that's how I've always operated. And I knew that if I wrote a book, I would have to then produce. So yeah, the two things were very kind of intertwined.
It sort of plays in there. There's been this whole theme of participatory journalism that's been big in recent years, you know, live an entire year only by the rules in the Bible. There are all sorts of these books that have come out. Was it an easy sell?
You mean for a publisher?
Yeah.
No. I think the first, my agent was immediately taken with the idea. He loved it. And then he spent a season trying to sell it. And what happened was a number of editors at major publishing houses liked the first chapter a lot. But the salespeople were kind of flummoxed. They didn't know how they would sell it. Would it, you know, because it just crossed so many kind of boundaries. Was it self-help? Was it memoir? Was it, you know, was it history? Where would they even place it in the bookstores? And it waited for about a year, and I actually gave up on the idea. And then I remember one day I was talking to, I met a writer who I'd always admired, and we were having dinner together. And I told her about this idea of mine and said, you know, I kind of gave up on it, but it was, you know, something that I had considered seriously. And she looked at me and said, if your agent can't sell it for you, I will. And this was somebody who I, as I said, I really respected. And I went back to my agent and said, try again. And at that point, I'm not sure what changed, but we got it sold very quickly.
How long in all did the writing process take you?
Well, the challenge as soon as I got the contract was to really, I had been playing the piano seriously all through this period, you know, 2-3 hours a day, but just, you know, kind of for myself. But once I got the contract, then I knew I had to really get serious. So I not only was doing the reporting, but I was doing the practicing and all the work. I was reaching out to performance coaches and psychologists, and I found a new teacher who was really going to push me hard and work with me and believe in me. And I started, you know, just kind of looking at all these different strategies. So I gave, from that point, from the time of the contract to my concert, was 1 year. And I was supposed to get the book in, I think, around the same time, maybe a month or two after that. But so much of my time had been spent playing the piano and practicing towards this event that had just kind of grown in my mind and taken up such enormity that by the end of, as I was approaching my deadline, I realized that I really needed more time for the writing. And I got about another 5-month extension. And I forget now when I got the book in. I think it was February or March after following the, so that would have been 2013, 2014. Yeah, so it was maybe a year and a half.
It's one of those things, those of us who write journalism on tight deadlines, as I do myself also, the idea of having a five-month extension is pretty remarkable, and I'm accustomed to turning things around as you are in a matter of hours or days or at most weeks. Talk about the actual process, you know, as being somebody who had written primarily short pieces. I read through the book, and so many of these chapters in a lot of ways could almost stand on their own as magazine articles within the longer theme here. Was that deliberate? Does that just follow from what you've been doing in the rest of your career that you would structure it that way?
Well, that, I think, kind of grew out of my conversations with the publisher, because I think they really wanted something that went beyond my own story. They wanted something to, you know, they saw, and what I saw originally was that there would be this very clear narrative arc following my story from childhood through, you know, like moving away from the piano back to it and then arriving at this place where, you know, it was like, you know, you either have success or failure, and you know, so it creates an inherent tension in the book. And I was certainly full of tension during that year. But they were interested in also drawing in people from outside the world of music. They wanted it to appeal and be read by people who aren't just musicians. And I guess as we talked about it, I saw the value in that. What that meant, though, was that it allowed me to, and it forced me to kind of create these, you know, kind of standalone chapters that addressed other people's lives and how they dealt with it. And that was not hard to find.
And you traveled quite extensively. I mean, the number of interviews that you did hear, you know, from the obvious talking to doctors, talking to music teachers, you dip into, and we'll talk about this more a little later in the hour, talking to sports figures, mm-hmm. about their experiences with the yips, if you will, and then even talking to, and this was an eye-opener for me, talking to Benjamin in Israel, who has this unusual form of stage fright, or social phobia, if you will, imat zibur, fear of the community. Talk about that
right.
A little bit. That fascinated me.
Yeah, I found that fascinating too. But in all honesty, I did not go to Israel and interview Benjamin. That came out of a study, and the only study of its kind, fascinatingly, by an Israeli psychiatrist who wrote about this phenomenon, imat zibur, that nobody even in this country had heard of. I did a lot of reporting, and I called rabbis and, you know, the Hebrew Union Theology, and people, it was one of those phrases that traced back to the Babylonian Talmud, and it refers to a kind of a law for the rabbi who must, when he addresses his congregation, should turn his back on God and actually face the congregation. And it's almost contraindicative of it, because you'd think that the fear would be more about God than the community. And it literally means fear of the community. But instead, it's kind of, there are different interpretations, but one is that the real responsibility lies to the community. So that's how it was understood historically. But in Israel and among Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews today, it's taken on this other connotation, which is men, and it's all men because they're the ones who have a public religious responsibility. And these are ultra-Orthodox Jewish men who have a fear of saying the blessings, chanting, you know, participating fully in the life of their synagogue, even though they're completely educated and prepared and knowledgeable in what they do. They have a fear of the community. And this Israeli psychiatrist talked to many who said, I mean, who now just say quite clearly, I have imat zibur, I can't do this anymore.
And then you move on from there to travel to Topeka, Kansas, and you talk to a pastor with stage fright.
Yes, an evangelical pastor, Larry Smith, who has had stage fright for many years. And what was fascinating was he went and practiced and preached in St. Petersburg, Russia, for quite a number of years. And he would have these, you know, like dreadful symptoms. And people there, he said, were not sympathetic and did not appreciate the fact that he fell apart and were very critical of it. And I found the cultural differences in that, instead of the kind of sympathy that he found here in the heartland in Russia, where he spent like 15 years. People were quite hostile to him, and many of them left because they felt that as their teacher, their guide, their preacher, he should have enough control of himself to set a standard. They wanted him to be more self-possessed than he was able to be.
And you have this wonderful scene where you go to watch him preach one morning in Kansas, and you're watching him do a half-hour sermon with his hand shaking and and his throat drying up.
Right. And his stomach for the couple days beforehand, which is when I first arrived in Kansas, he had an upset stomach. And he said that this was, in fact, the weekly routine that he went through. And every week was a countdown to Sunday for him. And yet he found value in it and persisted.
He said, this is what God has in mind for me, and this is what I'm doing, right?
That's what he thought.
We are talking with Sarah Solovich, the author of Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. Hope you'll join us as well. You can call in at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I am on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. Invite you to join us there as well with your comments or your questions or your experiences, too. If this is something that you've dealt with and you're interested in talking to Sarah about it, we invite you to call in and share that as well. We will continue with more discussion of Playing Scared, and we remind you also to check out our website at WXXINews.org. You can see our complete rundown of our guests for the rest of the week. We'll be talking young adults on Wednesday. We'll be talking a little bit about graphic novels on Thursday. A lot more coming up on Summer Book Week, and we hope you will stay with us as Connections continues here on member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5 in Rochester, FM 89.5 in the Finger Lakes. Listen online at WXXI.org or use the WXXI mobile app, too. Tuesday on Connections, Summer Book Week continues with a conversation with author David McCullough about his new book, The Wright Brothers.
We must not ignore the miracle that these two extraordinary Americans brought about. Who were they? How'd they do it? What kind of human beings were they? That's what I was out to find out.
And we'll talk to a panel of local editors and publishers about Rochester's book business. I'm Scott Feibusch. Join me Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Village at Unity, independent senior living that supports an active, independent lifestyle, offering hospitality, personal transportation, and other amenities. The Village at Unity, like no other. For tours, call 723-7442.
It's Connections from member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, on the first day of our Summer Book Week. Here on Connections, we are talking with Sarah Solovich, who is the author of Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright, and she is joining us from the studios of KAZU on the beautiful California coast. Thank you for joining us from California. I appreciate your being with us for the hour. You're not nervous being on the radio. You're not nervous talking in public about basically anything other than actually sitting down and playing the piano, right?
That's right. I mean, of course, I get a few butterflies in my stomach when I get up to speak before a group of people or to stand here and talk on the radio. But I think that's a good thing because it signifies that there's something special about what I'm doing. It's not like sitting in a cafe shooting the breeze with my friends. It's, you know, there's something that's special and distinct about what I'm doing. And I can rise to the occasion. But in playing the piano, what stopped me was I was able to do it fine, or as one of my teachers as an adult said, I could handle the piano fine. I just couldn't handle myself at the piano. So that was what I really had to learn to do during this year of what I called living dangerously.
And I want to talk a little bit about your work through. It sort of bookends the book at the beginning and then at the end of it, as you work your way up to performing a recital that is all you. You start out a little smaller than that, going to the San Jose airport and just performing while people are walking by, probably paying not that much attention to you. What was that right. experience like? How did you decide to go and do and start by doing that?
Well, it's funny because when I did it, and I did it about every 10 days or 2 weeks, it didn't strike me as something that was particularly interesting. It was my exposure therapy, my teacher at the time, when I first got really serious about this, she's actually my current teacher. She had suggested this. She was going to take her, she had a few young students, and she was bringing them to the airport and having a recital there. And she dragged me along and insisted that I accompany her. And I realized after that one experience that it was valuable to me because it just kind of inured me to the experience of getting up and doing something over and over again and not worry whether, you know, I made a mistake and what would people think of me, because people weren't paying any attention. They didn't care what I was doing. Most of them just walked on by and they were on their cell phones and they were chatting to their, each other, their kid, yelling at their kids, getting their baggage. The piano's right outside the baggage claim area of the Southwest Terminal. But what at the time, as I was doing it, it really didn't seem particularly interesting. You know, I would go there and lay all my music out and play for 20 or 30 minutes, and then I would get back in my car and go home. And it wasn't until afterwards in the writing that I recognized that this was kind of interesting in and of itself. I mean, it's like many things that happen, I think, as you're writing something, a magazine story or a book. I mean, in the experience itself, it's not necessarily that engaging. It's only when you go back and you're sitting at your computer and, you know, looking at this empty screen and trying to figure out what was it that makes that made this story special. And suddenly, out of all this information that you gather, it's all funneling into, you know, somewhere. And you start to pick out the things that are really, that come alive for you. And in this case, it was like after months of doing this that suddenly I realized, hey, this is, you know, this was really useful. This really served a purpose. And it's a very vivid and kind of graphic illustration of what I was up to. And I didn't quite recognize it at the time.
And it's interesting because it's something that's so vitally important to you to be there and to be doing that. And you're just sort of a blur in somebody else's mind as they're all pouring past you.
Right. Because what happened as I played, and this became, I think this was increasing, I was able to develop focus. And that became so much a part of what I had to learn as a pianist and a performer. I had it when I would play at home, and when I went to my lesson, I was very focused. But in the midst of all this anxiety and fear and adrenaline, I would lose my focus, and I would start thinking about other things and, you know, just all this kind of detritus would come flooding into my brain, and I would just lose my ability to think about the music. And so that became, I think, really a way for me to channel it once more as I was sitting at the airport piano.
Have you heard from anybody since who's recognized that and said, oh, that's who that was playing the piano. I didn't realize what I was looking at.
I have heard from a couple people, or they've asked me, were you the one who was playing Chopin that day? And sometimes I would write back and say, no, that wasn't me. People, you know, that just have a very, they're, I mean, it's funny what the tricks of memory. Somebody wrote to me and said, were you playing a Chopin mazurka? It turned out it was a man that he had watched, and yet he wrote to me and asked me if I was the person. But in some cases, yeah, it was in fact me.
You go on from there to do a recital with several other performers at a library.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some wonderful quotes that you work in going into that, the Vladimir Horowitz quote.
Oh, yeah. Horowitz was a friend of a young pianist. What was her name? Olga?
Gita Gordova.
Gita Gordova, that's yeah. Right. I actually emailed with her son, who's about this story. And she was a really fine pianist. I believe it was back in the 50s or 60s. And she was going to a concert. She was playing at Carnegie Hall. And I'm not sure if it was her debut, but it was a solo concert. And they were riding in a taxi. And he told her, for God's sake, don't stop. Whatever you do, don't stop. Whatever happens, don't stop. It's so provincial. And that was what I really brought with me into that library, you know, recital. Don't stop, whatever you do.
And Horowitz himself had to be pulled on stage physically just to get up there and avoid running away.
Yeah, isn't that an amazing story? That it took three burly men to come in and drag him out of the green room and toss him out literally on stage. But, you know, he's not the only great pianist. I heard a story of Ravel, actually, Maurice Ravel, who, when he came to Boston to conduct some of his works, had to be thrown out on stage, you know, to conduct. And he also had a fear of performance.
Is there an opposite? Did you talk to people who've had the experience saying, you know what, I love doing this. I get all my energy from going out there and being in front of the lights. Is that sort of a parallel experience that you found?
Yeah, definitely. There are musicians, and especially I think some solo pianists who feel that they come completely alive when they perform. But then there are also a lot of jazz musicians, including my own son, who plays better, you know, on stage than he ever does when he's in his room. But I think that, you know, for jazz, it's a different story. You know, you make a mistake and it's almost like that mistake takes you in another direction. There's not such a demand for perfection. And that, you know, the combination of the memory, the, you know, requirement, and that's starting to change, but that one has to have everything memorized and not deviate at all from the printed page, that every note has to be played perfectly, creates a fear among many musicians, even the greatest.
Is there a danger to getting too comfortable? Is there a danger to saying, you know what, this is no big thing. I'll go up, I'll do this. And you know, I started wondering as I was reading your book, this is a zone that I find myself very comfortable in, sitting in a microphone, talking to people about various things. And I don't get nervous about it. I enjoy it. I look forward to it. And I'm reading this and I'm wondering, should I be thinking more seriously about this? Should I be more of a perfectionist than I am? And I actually found myself in recording some of the billboards and promos for the show today, going back saying, you know, nope, I could have done that better. I'm going to take a minute and do that even better. I guess what I'm asking is there a value to the pressure that stage fright and the perfectionism that seems to go with it brings to a performance?
Yeah, I think that a lot of times there is some, because if one doesn't have that kind of, you know, inherent demand for perfection and, you know, high expectation of oneself, then you don't work as hard. You're not going to demand as much from yourself. But there's also a fine line between striving for excellence and mastery and perfectionism. And the two aren't necessarily the same.
And you dig pretty deep here, and we don't even have time within the hour to get into all of it, but you dig pretty deep here into the mental aspects of this, into the physiological aspects. I want to talk in particular about the use of beta blockers, because you spend some time on the pros and cons of the, quote, public speaking pill, unquote. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, beta blockers are, you know, one of the most widely prescribed medications in the U.S. There's something like 128 million prescriptions written for them every year. And they're called beta blockers because they block the heart's adrenaline-responsive beta receptors. They work by slowing the nerve impulses that run through the heart, and they make the heart pump less forcefully and lower your blood pressure. And the vast majority of the prescriptions is for high blood pressure and heart disease. But there is a strong niche market for performance anxiety. And in fact, the studies that I've seen, and there aren't that many recent ones, but they typically show that up to 30% of symphony orchestra musicians take beta blockers on a fairly regular or on a somewhat regular basis. In fact, the musicians who I've talked with say that that is a real lowball estimate. That I've talked to people who said, we all take them. I mean, they don't necessarily take them all the time. They don't take them, for instance, to go into a rehearsal or even to play every concert. But certainly they do if they're auditioning. Then you can just assume that the entire place is awash in beta blockers. But, you know, there's also a joke that an IV drip of propranolol, which is the beta blocker that's usually meant when you talk about them for performance anxiety, that that an IV drip of propranolol hangs over every orchestra pit in the world.
I love that anecdote that you tell here about the doctor who's watching one orchestra musician lecture the others about why they shouldn't use beta blockers, and sitting there thinking, wait a minute, I just prescribed them for this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is that sort of connotation, and you quote some people as saying, well, it makes the playing less alive, it deadens it, it makes it more rote. Do you think that's the case?
I think for some people it absolutely is. And they know who they are, and they respond accordingly. And then there are some, too, and I've spoken with a few pianists, actually, who said they would use it if they could, but they have an allergy or they're asthmatic, and there are actual physical, you know, like health reasons why they can't use beta blockers. So one should always get it from their doctor. In fact, that often isn't the case. Musicians tend to share them quite liberally with each other.
You mentioned rehearsals, and a lot of those often are conducted behind curtains so that you're not swayed by the physical appearance.
The audition. Yeah.
The audition. My producer, John Andrus, chimed in with a question here. Would you have been less nervous with some of these performances if there had been a curtain between you and the audience and you couldn't see them, or was just knowing that they were there, would that still have done it to you?
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, that's a good question. It's really, I can't even imagine it, you know, for a recital. So much of it is also visual. You know, I think that audiences in general listen as much with their eyes as they do with their ears sometimes. So I can't even imagine that being, you know, the case.
I want to go to the phones, and we'll take your calls, too, at 844-295-TALK or on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. Mary Jane in Webster, you had a question about stage fright.
Well, I remember a pastor I knew who was scared every Sunday morning and had to go through a very bad thing of throwing up before he was strong enough to go on to his church to preach. He was afraid of getting up in the pulpit and preaching. And I was an actor and spent a lot of time on stages in Rochester. And that waiting in the wings to go on with your first line, I used this. In my thinking, I was saying to myself, the 23rd Psalm, and it was the most calming thing, and I didn't forget my first line before I went on. That's a great story.
Thanks for the story, Mary Jane. I guess everybody has their own things that they do, their own ways of doing it. You talk pretty extensively in the book about this practice of centering that you learned and then had to get yourself right back into as you got into that final recital.
Yes, that was something that was taught to me by a sports psychologist named Dawn Green, who has worked with a lot of musicians. And he started working with musicians in New York when a voice teacher at Juilliard found out about, you know, like some of his teachings and his research. And she brought him in to work with a number of her students who were entering taking auditions at the end of the year. And the ones he worked with did so well, they all placed, that Juilliard was really influenced, and they ended up hiring him as a professor on their faculty. And he was there for several years. And one of his students was a violinist named Noah Kageyama, who decided during his master's couple years there that he didn't want to be a violinist and ended up following in Dawn Green's footsteps and does similar work now at Juilliard. But what they teach is the kind of the mainstay of their teaching is centering. It's just kind of finding, you know, like grounding yourself, bringing yourself into complete focus and concentration. And once you get there, the idea is that you are kind of impenetrable. You're just all working from the inside out.
And you write about how as you get to this recital at the end of the book, and you've got more than 100 people flown in, some of them from pretty far out of town to be with you, and your family's there, and you forgot to center at first.
Yeah, at that very final recital, I was, I just was so overwhelmed by the whole experience. I had been, kind of in the basement of the church, really preparing myself. And then I came out and saw all these people. And I just, for the first piece, I really just lost it. I mean, it wasn't terrible. I kept going. But there were a couple moments where I faltered. And I wondered if I was going to make it.
And then you did. We're not gonna sing. Don't want to let the audience down.
Spoiler alert.
Indeed. Have you performed again since then?
Yes, I have. And I continue to. In fact, I'm working toward another recital, a solo recital, which will be at the downtown library in Santa Cruz, where I live, in 3 weeks, actually.
Are you as nervous still, or was there anything in the process of writing the book and in the process of learning as much as you learned? Did any of that help take the edge off of it?
Well, the difference now is that I know I can do it. But, it's not like planting your flag on the moon and knowing that you're cured and that everything is going to be okay and you're never going to have stage fright again. So sometimes it strikes me more than others, and it will always be something that kind of I have to deal with if I'm going to continue playing the piano. And I am not a natural performer by any means, but I am able, I now have a lot of tools in my toolbox, and I'm able to kind of bring them all together and rise to the occasion.
What would you tell the younger you if somebody who was of that age, 16, 17, and starting to find that they have this issue, where would you set them now? Or what advice would you give them?
I think that what I would have said, what I would say to myself now, is that you do not have to do this. You don't have to perform, and you certainly don't have to compete. And you can say no. And this was something that I didn't even assume it just didn't even occur to me that I could say no at that age. And in fact, one of the psychologists I spoke to was so insightful. I was telling her my story, and her response was, your stage fright kind of became your friend in a way. It was your body's way of saying no when your brain and your mouth wasn't able to do that.
Fascinating. I promised we were going to get some sports in here, and you have a fantastic chapter talking to Steve Sachs, who, if you were not a Dodgers fan in the 1970s, you may not remember that just massive collapse that he had where the ball went anywhere except where he was trying to throw it. 1980s, I should say, early 1980s.
83,
yeah. And then all of a sudden, with a little help from his dad, which you tell kind of movingly there, all of a sudden he was back, and he became a fine ball player. And yet when people say Steve Sachs, you remember those
That's
those
all
three
they
months.
Remember.
Yeah,
it was just really only 3 months. And then he went on to have this amazing career. That, you know, he went on to the New York Yankees, and he just had, you know, like a, you know, fantastic stats and RBIs. But those 3 months in 1983, when he just completely lost the ability to throw from second to first and second to home, is what people all remember about him. And during that period, you know, he got death threats that were so bad he had to turn the letters over to the FBI.
And, of the threats, you know, from the gamblers.
From fans, yeah. And, you know, the bettors were furious at him because he destroyed, you know, all their betting. you know, people had all kinds of suggestions for him, including his manager, Tommy Lasorda, who took him out for dinner, took the whole team out for dinner in Philadelphia after they played the Phillies one night. And Sachs woke up the next morning and found the head of a pig on the pillow next to him. And it was, you know, it was from Lasorda. It was his idea of a joke that, you know, it was signed something like, Sachs, you better start playing better or else. And it didn't work. did work was his father's advice. He was very kind of in awe of his father. And his father had also been a very good ball player in high school. And when his father was on his deathbed, he told him, I had the same problem as you, and it's only a matter of confidence. You need to start chipping away at it. Like you're taking an axe to a tree, just one chop at a time, and you'll get your confidence back. And the next time, you know, a day after that, his dad died. But he took that advice to heart, and he just started, as he said, chipping away and slathering himself with advice. Every time he threw well, he would give himself a pat on the back. But the fascinating thing was that years later, he was talking to his mother about this conversation, the last conversation he had with his dad. And his mother, who had been like with his father since they were fifth graders or something like that, she looked at him and said, your dad never had a throwing problem. you know, he never went through what you had. And at that point, Sachs realized that his dad, who could be abusive and, like, you know, just physically terrifying, had really given him the greatest gift that he could have possibly given him.
Remarkable. Playing Scared is the name of the book. Sarah Solovich is the author, with Western New York connections in Southern Ontario and then in Hornell and here at the Eastman School. We have time for one more quick phone call. Betty in Fairport, you're married to someone who has stage fright?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. My husband plays the piano, and he often plays not the jazz, but the pieces where precision is important. And it can be very painful and, you know, really trying to figure out how I could help. So this topic on the radio is just wonderful to hear. And I have not read the book yet. So I'm just wondering, you know, how do people who live with somebody that have, you know, performance anxieties and, you know, how does somebody help?
Well, I can tell you that the most important thing for me was to actually do it. I had spent so many years running away from this and finding excuses not to play. And most people who knew me as an adult didn't know that I played the piano. It was something that I just didn't share. And so I would say to sit with him when he plays, you know, and encourage and support him, and maybe occasionally, you know, ask if he'd like to have some people over for dinner. And then before dinner, or at, you know, before you sit down for dessert, go to the, have him ask if he'd like to go to the piano and play something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, thank you.
Great questions. Sure. Thank you. Thank you so much. And John Andrews suggested be there to turn the pages as he plays too. Might not be
there
a bad
you go.
Idea. Very quick questions. We get towards the end of this hour here. Now that you have the book under your belt and it's out there in the world, what's the reaction been like? And is there another book in you now?
The reaction's been wonderful, actually. And it's been international, which is kind of staggering. I've been hearing from people all around the world about it. As far as another book goes, I don't know. I would love to write something. I'm happiest when I'm really immersed in a project and just fully committed to something. So I want to get back there. That's my next goal. But I will always continue playing the piano and play, and performing a little bit.
Perhaps a recital in Rochester one of these days in the future. Do you still have connections back here? Are there...
No, unhappily, I don't. My family all left there a number of years ago.
You're always welcome back here.
To you.
We'll get you on a recital on our Classical 91.5 sister station someday, perhaps.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sarah Solovich, the author of A History and Memoir of Stage Fright, Playing Scared. Keep an eye on our book list. It is at WXXINews.org and click on Summer Book Week. We are back tomorrow with a discussion with local publishers and editors, and then David McCullough in the second hour. I'm Scott Feibusch, John Andrus behind the board. This is Connections from member-supported public radio.